Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So, hi, my name is Rachel. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent, and this is another podcast for the New Book Network Sex, Sexualities, and Sex Work channel. And today I'm really excited to speak to Stefan Vogler, if I got that right, about his book, Sorting Sexualities. So, Stefan, can you tell the readers who you are and what your research interests are, please?
Sure, yeah. So, as Rachel said, my name is Stefan, and right now I'm a research scientist at NORC at the University of Chicago. Before that, I did a couple postdocs, like a lot of us do, and before that, got my PhD at Northwestern in sociology. And so, my research is really concerned with, surprise, sexuality, but really around the ways that sexuality is regulated and the way it intersects with law and science. And so the way that law and science co-produce sexuality is a big theme in the book. I've studied a lot on LGBTQ asylum, looking at the ways that asylum seekers can come to the United States and seek protection on account of their sexualities. But as I'm sure we'll talk about, one of the things they have to do is prove that they are whatever sexual identity they say they are when they come. And so that really got me interested in studying that arena. I've also done work on sex crimes, so studying how we assess risk in sex offenders, how those actually become identities that the legal system uses to govern people. So as you're probably gathering, I'm very Foucauldian in my approach to studying sexuality. But, you know, I like to bring in a lot of different perspectives. So I always say I sort of follow this intersection of sociology and legal studies and science studies and queer studies. And so I draw on a lot of different disciplines and really think of myself as an interdisciplinary scholar in that way.
Yeah.
That's a little bit about myself and where I'm coming from.
Excellent. So before we really launch into the book, why the book now? Why now?
Yeah, well, as our readers or listeners surely know, it takes quite a while to produce a book. So I started writing this, 8 years ago, 7 years ago, something like that. I think I happened to hit on a topic that has become even more relevant over time. I mean, especially as we've seen multiple, you know, quote unquote immigration crises. But I really chose this topic because I didn't feel like we were paying enough attention to how the state, so to speak, and I use that with some big air quotations because, of course, the state is a disjointed entity, right? It's not just some unified thing. It has many arms, to use Morgan and Orloff's recent book title, or many hands, I guess they say. I didn't feel like we were looking at that too much in the U.S. context, especially. So we do, I think the scholars, there have been some scholars who've done amazing work on how sexuality is regulated vis-a-vis the state in historical context and post-colonial context. But I didn't feel like we had much looking at the contemporary West. And so So I really got interested in you know, looking at this relationship between sexuality and the state. And, you know, so I've always sort of been interested in how how the state essentially uses sexuality as a vector of power or regulation. And so that's a big theme in the book. And that was really the big thing that, you know, attracted me to this topic. But then the individual topics, especially asylum, right, I really started getting interested in because I was interested in the politics of immigration and especially how sexuality was involved in that.
That's interesting. So in the introduction, you described two separate examples of defining sexualities. And they're still central to the book. So can you tell us what they are and how did they lead to you writing the book?
Yeah, so the two examples, I assume you're talking about the big case studies for the book, which on the one hand is LGBTQ asylum law, and the other is sex offender law, specifically sex offender civil commitment law, which is... not specific to the United States, but quite a bit larger in the United States than in most other countries. So initially, I started studying asylum, which I actually sort of learned about by happenstance. I didn't even know, and I think some of our listeners won't know, right, that you can actually, or you might now, because it's been in the news a lot since I've started doing this research, but you can get asylum, you know, political asylum, based on your sexual or gender identity. So if you're being persecuted because of your sexuality in your home country, you can come to the United States or a handful of other countries, and you can actually seek protection based on that. You can say, hey, I'm being persecuted based on my sexuality or my gender. My gender identity, and I would like to seek asylum here. And you have to go through a big legal process, but essentially when I was a first-year graduate student, I was doing some volunteer work for a nonprofit, and I learned that they actually were representing asylum seekers, and I was like, oh, this is a thing, and okay. Well, I was already interested in how the state, you know, regulate sexuality. And so this really like piqued my interest. And then I learned that one of the things you have to do in this area of law is prove that you are gay, for example, or prove that you are trans. And I was like, okay, well, how are people proving that they're gay to an immigration court? And that was really the driving question that started all of this, is like, how are people proving their sexualities to the state? Right, or to these legal complexes. And so I really started diving into asylum law. And I studied that for a couple of years. And I was like, you know, this is clearly happening in other places, right? This isn't just, you know, a phenomenon. At least my hunch was, you know, this is happening in other places, right? And so I sort of went on a hunt for other realms where, you know, the state or the law, right, were exerting this type of regulation, right, where places sort of had to prove their, or people had to prove their sexualities or something like that. And I went through a number of things like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, right, in the United States, where, you know, where military service members had to defend themselves against claims or accusations that they would be gay, and a number of other sort of arenas. And I ultimately, again, sort of happened to come across the sex offender civil commitment laws, which again was something I didn't know existed when I, you know, initially started thinking about this research. But as I started looking into it, so how civil commitment works, just to give everyone a little background, is that when a sex offender, there are 21 jurisdictions in the United States. So 19 states plus Washington, D.C. plus the federal government, mm-hmm, have these statutes that allow the state to seek the indefinite confinement of a sex offender after they have finished serving their criminal sentence.
Wow.
So, right, yeah, I mean, it seems very anathema to how our justice system is supposed to work, right? They're essentially being tried for the same crime a second time, but the way they get around that is by putting it in the civil realm. And so they get around all sorts of double jeopardy and ex post facto and, you know, all these legal, you know, terms that a lot of people aren't going to care about, but that are very important here. And so, but again, part of then what has to happen is that in this case, the state has to prove that this person is whatever they claim they are, so that they are a pedophile or they are a sadist or that they are a rapist. But they do this in a way that actually turns that from a set of behaviors, right? When we think of sex crimes, we think of, okay, you did this thing, right? You committed a rape and now you're being punished for it. But actually in civil commitment, they sort of create an identity around this, right? So it's not just this simple, like we're punishing you for a behavior. We actually have forensic psychologists come in and they really give them a DSM, a diagnosis from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is sort of the holy Bible of psychiatric diagnoses here in the United States. And they will say, like, this person is a sexually violent predator or a sexually violent person. And that doesn't just become, or that isn't just, you know, a signifier, right? That is a legal identity. And it becomes, and actually the forensic psychologist that I interview see these things as sexual identities akin to how we talk about gay and straight. So there's actually a lot of psychological literature around how this group of psychologists, especially that do these civil commitment hearings, see things like pedophilia and sadism as sexual orientations. Okay. And so that's sort of a long-winded way of giving you how I came about these cases and, you know, why I ended up putting them together is because they seem like really weird, sort of a really weird comparison, right? Like, we don't think of gayness being associated with pedophilia anymore, right? We have a sort of knee-jerk reaction against that, especially those of us who are sort of, you know, progressives or, you know, sex-positive folks, right? And so I really wanted to sort of challenge that common sense and say, like, you know, let's put this common sense under a microscope and see how this division happened, how these are actually operating in these two legal spheres.
So I'm really interested in what you were saying about the sort of sex criminals in some parts of the United States. So you can serve your crime, but then you can be further incarcerated if you're ascribed this identity, which presumably makes it very easy to ascribe if you've just been prosecuted for an offense that describes you as such.
Yeah. So north of 90% of these civil commitment claims end up being upheld, right? Or they end up being convicted, to use, you know, I guess they wouldn't necessarily say convicted because it's a civil hearing, but they end up being civilly committed. So it's a very, very high success rate for the state. But yeah. So the way you summarized it is exactly true. In these 21 jurisdictions, after you've served your criminal sentence, the state can elect to pursue a civil commitment hearing after that. And if they are successful, the sex offender will be put into a psychiatric treatment facility for an indefinite amount of time. And in practice, what ends up happening is it ends up becoming a life sentence for most of them without the concomitant legal protections that you get in a criminal setting.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a little crazy. Wow. And I mean, it's not a sympathetic population. So a lot of people are sort of like, whatever. But like, these are these sort of skirt, these edge issues, right? We're we have these exceptional forms of law for sex offenders or for terrorists, right? They end up encroaching over time onto, they will get expanded to other populations, right? And so I think it's important that we pay attention to these, sort of edge cases, even if they aren't a sympathetic population.
So how many jurisdictions did you say this applies to?
So 21. It's 19 states plus Washington, D.C., which is not a state yet, but hopefully soon. and then the federal government also can elect to pursue it if someone is charged on a federal basis rather than in a state.
I've got a really horrible feeling that these states, are they probably southern states with a large proportion of these people that are exposed to this type of double incarceration, possibly black?
So that's a good guess, and that is what I would have guessed too, but it's actually a really diverse array of states. And so the first state to actually pass it was Washington State. Wow. Which is a fairly liberal, it's a blue state. But what happened is there was a really high profile sex crime that happened from someone from an ex-convict who told officials, like, if you let me out, I'm going to commit another crime. And they had no choice but to let him out. His sentence was over. And so they released him, and basically immediately after he was released, he assaulted and mutilated a small boy. And it was a heinous crime, right? I mean, it was horrible. And the Washington legislature reacted almost like immediately. Within the year, the law was passed. He was civilly committed. He became the first person in the country to be civilly committed under these new laws. But then the laws spread from there. So California has one, Texas, Florida, Minnesota, Illinois, where I am here in Chicago. It's a wide array of states, both geographically and politically, ideologically. So I think actually, a really interesting project for some intrepid sexuality scholar who wants to do this would be tracing how these laws actually came about and what was, the driving force behind them. Because I think in most of these cases, it was sort of these high profile crimes really catalyzed the passage of a new set of laws. And it really, they came on the heels of the sort of satanic ritual abuse panic of the like 1980s, where in the United States there was this panic around child abuse, child sexual abuse, sort of what we're seeing with QAnon right now. Mm-hmm. But sort of even more mainstream than that, it had a lot of coverage. And so we saw a lot of these harsher crimes around sex and sexuality getting passed at this time. And these were one of them. Okay.
We're talking about the 1980s then, which is quite interesting, isn't it? When you think in terms of, the 1980s, massive incarceration, that increased criminalization, increased extension of the carceral system. And this is a slightly more subtle way of going about it. It's very Foucauldian, isn't it? That kind of incarceration of those, the unnecessaries, like that he talks about in the 18th century.
Oh, very much.
Yeah. I mean, Foucault is all over this book. Biopolitics, governmentality. Oh,
very much. I'm definitely a Foucault fan.
Yeah, you've definitely got the t-shirt. So, in the book, you discuss state institutions, legal and scientific actors working together to co-produce sexuality as a regulating category. Can you talk us through this?
Yeah. So, again, this is anyone who recognizes Foucault will recognize this general sort of theoretical thrust behind that argument. But I'm also drawing on the idea of co-production from science studies. And so really, to sort of break it down, what I'm saying is that the state, and specifically these legal institutions, in conjunction with different forms of science, come together to really create these form, these they don't create these sexual identities wholesale, right? But they work to naturalize distinctions along the lines of sexuality by sort of importing cultural currents into the state vis-a-vis these expert discourses. I feel like you asked me to break it down and then I'm like, let me be more intellectual about it. So let me try to be like a little more straightforward about it. So I think one of the things that I'm trying to show here is that sexuality really takes on these different valences, these different realities, even depending on the institutional context. And so even as we sort of think of sexuality as being more and more liberated in the US or in the West in general, you know, in relation to things like the legalization of gay marriage or, you know, the ability to serve in the military if you're, you know, and be openly gay. Even as we think of these things as sort of liberating sexuality, what I'm really trying to show is that these are also the flip side of these things is also that we're creating new ways of regulating sexuality, right? So, so we create this area of asylum law, which I'm not going to sit here and say this is bad, right? This gives, you know, this is in some ways a very positive development. It allows people who really are in danger for their lives to get needed protection. But at the same time, it only allows certain people to avail themselves of those protections, right? And it does it by creating these circumscribed identity categories. So what does it mean to be gay under asylum law? Well, for a while, it meant that you were, when this area of law was forming in the like late 80s, early 1990s, what it really meant is that you sort of quote-unquote looked gay enough, right? Or you acted gay enough. So you were an effeminate man or a butch lesbian, and a judge could look at you and be like, yeah, they look gay to me. That sounds good. But as we all know, that is not a good way of judging who is gay or who is queer in any way, right? So this group of activists and experts and human rights experts, academics, they came together and they really challenged this idea that there was this like common sense, you know, we can just look at you and know that you're gay, or you can show us some pictures of you having sex with a man, or, you know, if you're another man. And this still actually has happened. And in the UK, in fact, right, the Home Office gets a lot of flack in the press if you look at that, about, you know, asking really invasive questions like, are you a top or a bottom? And how many people have you had sex with? And, you know, all sorts of really invasive questions that aren't, again, needed to sort of prove someone's gay or to show someone's identity. And so this group of this sort of hybrid network of experts, as I talk about in the book, came together to really challenge this. And they've really moved the standards of proof away from being about these sort of bodily indicators, and moved it more towards being about identity and a narrative of this person's sort of life, right? So you narrate this sort of, I mean, it still becomes a sort of coming out narrative, so it still can be problematic in that sense, right? It's still a sort of Western trope. But you create these sort of circumscribed ways of, you know, identities of what it means to be gay or what it means to be a lesbian or bisexual or transgender or what have you. And so So that's really what I'm talking about when I say they create these new regulatory categories, right? They create the queer asylum seeker. And what does that mean to be a queer asylum seeker? Or they create the sexually violent predator. But of course, as I argue in the book, right, they measure these things, they conceptualize sexuality very differently in these two realms, which I'm sure we'll talk more about. So I'll leave it at that for now. But
what the sense I got when I was reading this book for like what came to me is, and it's quite an odd kind of concept, but I think it bears consideration, is the debate that you have about the legalization of marijuana in some parts of the state. So that kind of like the legalization of marijuana allows certain sets of people to be taken away from the criminal justice system, yeah, and leaving some behind. So for example, you know, sort of like, you know, the areas in the United States where it's, you can buy weed now is, you know, the weed is expensive, but it's legitimate. So what you do is you scoop out the middle class white people out of the grasp of the criminal justice system and still leave the poor and largely brown people behind to the, you know, to be consumed by the criminal justice system. And this strikes me as a similar pattern, in as much as people that were previously defined as being, you know, sort of like unwanted, yeah, and now being like sort of brought into the main body of society in some ways, but you know, like in other ways, other sort of sexualities are not just still not acceptable. There's a double indemnity for being, you know, to belonging to those groups.
Yeah.
And so, and that's what really struck me as I was reading the book. It's a kind of like, there's a sort of sifting going on here. It's like, there are some people in the criminal justice system that the criminal justice system probably thinks should be in the mainstream. So this is a way of kind of like bringing people into the fold while pushing others out, isn't it? I'd be really interested in the demographics of the people who were being sort of like civilly incarcerated after a prison sentence, because it strikes me you're going to be poor, aren't you? You're going to come out. You're going to be disadvantaged, and you're going to be poor.
Yeah, and that's one thing that's really hard to get. Surprise, the state does not want you to super know who these people are that are committed, right? So, a colleague, Trevor Hoppe, has been trying really hard to get this demographic information, and I got a little bit of it that I present in the book. I believe, yes. I couldn't remember. I got it right towards the tail end of writing the book, but I think I had a chance to incorporate it. what I found, we can't get much on class, but we do know, for instance, that, we don't know on a wide basis, but, based on my own research, most of the people can't afford private counsel when they are being tried for civil commitment, which we know, of course, is a sign of poverty, of low socioeconomic status. But when we get official statistics, so here in Illinois, for instance, I was able to get a racial breakdown. And it is, unsurprisingly, disproportionately Black men. But the other interesting thing is that when you look at it, the demographics are sort of a little bit surprising. So there are two main things that people get civilly committed for. The first is pedophilia, and the second is sadistic rape or serial rape. And so, which in diagnostic terms is often called other specified paraphilia non-consent, which is a very sort of loosey-goosey definition or diagnosis that I spend a whole chapter talking about in the book. when you look at those two categories, those who are committed for pedophilia or pedophilic disorder are about two-thirds white. And then when you look at those who are committed for rape, they're about two-thirds Black. And so you know, what that tells me, or what I suspect here, is that, you know, we are, you know, this is especially the rape side of things, right? That is sort of reflecting the racial composition of the criminal justice system more, you know, writ large in a sense, right? But it's also showing us that Black men are disproportionately punished, right? Especially for rape. Rape is being medicalized to further punish Black men more than white men for these crimes. Both at the large level, right? Black men are disproportionately represented overall in civil commitment, but then among those who commit rape, they're disproportionately civilly committed. And so what we also found, I actually worked on a report with the Williams Institute with my colleague, Trevor Hoppe, and some others recently. And what we also found is that it looks like also sexual minority men or men who have sex with men are disproportionately civilly committed as well. And so we can still see some of those knock-on effects of you know, this association between queerness and criminality, right? Mm-hmm. Because men who commit sex offenses against other men, right? So, you know, by definition, they are men who have sex with men. Whether they identify as gay or queer in any way, we don't necessarily know, but we do know that their crime was against another man. And from what we can tell from the very spotty data, they are disproportionately represented. And part of that is probably because of the type of risk assessment that they use. So there's something called the Static 99 or Static 99R, which is our actuarial risk assessment tool. And basically it's 10 questions and it's very easy to score. It's basically a sort of checkbox, like, you know, how old are you? Who was your crime against? And one of the questions on there is, did you have a male victim? And if you say yes to that question, it increases your risk score. And so we've actually built in, you know, sort of weighing male victims extra or as more risky into these risk assessment tools. And so that, along, I think, with some other things, really are contributing to an overrepresentation of both Black men and men who have sex with men.
But also as well, it like leads into really interesting debates about worthy victims, isn't it? It's like, you know, if you're a male victim of like a criminal, it's almost like the crime committed against you is weighted more heavily. In fact, weighted heavily enough so that the perpetrator does two sentences.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that just goes back to the way that we treat sexual violence in general, right? Mm. Which is that it's normalized against women. Right. It's for a man to rape a woman is sort of, I mean, and if we go back, you know, 50, 60 years, rape was seen as a more, you know, quote unquote, normal expression of male sexuality than homosexuality, than being gay. Right. It was seen as an overly aggressive expression of male sexual desire. Right. And so, so we were more likely at mid-century, the mid-20th century, to categorize homosexuality and pedophilia together, right, as similar types of sexual disorders, and then have rape sort of over here as like, yeah, that it's still heterosexual, so it's not quite as bad. It's not against nature, right? But also that goes to this normalization of sexual violence against women. And I think that we do see a heavier weighting of sex crimes against boys and men as being something that is much more damaging to them, right? Mm-hmm. Like it is going like if a boy is sexually molested or sexually assaulted, I think there's still this underlying fear that you have like irreparably damaged his sexuality. You've either turned him gay or something like that, right? There is, and actually my colleague Jamie Small has written about this. There is more of a fear of like damaged sexuality among boys when they're assaulted. And so I do think those cultural views find their way into the legal system in that way, right? And we do see these crimes against boys and men as more heinous in a sense than those against women and girls.
It's like the sense of loss is greater.
Yeah.
So I did really enjoy this book because it felt like Foucault 2.0. Yeah. So
thank you. I was hoping it wasn't just Foucault rehashed. I think it was 2.0. But
I realized is that, you know, sort of Foucault talks about sort of like the chattering classes talking stuff into and out of like legitimate behavior. And I was sort of thinking, so this time the chattering classes are actually different. The chattering classes in this case are the state and non-state actors, particularly experts. So can you talk about how the book discusses the state depending on non-state actors, particularly experts, to classify and categorize sexualities? Can you unpack this for us?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, the expertise that I talk about sort of two different kinds of expertise here. One, we've been talking about this forensic psychology, which really arose in response to these laws. And I talk a lot about how, you know, we had sexual psychopath laws earlier in the 20th century. And that was sort of during the time of institutionalization. And so institutional psychiatrists, you know, in these asylums were really the sort of experts here. Organized psychiatry really withdrew from that area of law in like the 1970s, 1980s. And this new discipline of forensic psychology really arose almost in response to these laws. Like a whole cottage industry has arisen in response to new sex offender laws, and especially the sexually violent predator laws, the civil commitment laws. And so in that instance, you know, we see this, right? This isn't an unusual thing for the law to turn to experts when they don't feel like they can answer a question on their own, right? So in the case of sex offenders, it really became built into the law. They actually said, hey, we need this specific form of evaluation. And so the law really set the standards for what type of expertise was even going to be able to weigh in on this topic, right? So they really set the standards. In asylum, it was a little different. In asylum, we have a more hybrid form of expertise. You can't really say that it's like sociologists or anthropologists alone, although sociologists and anthropologists are likely to be the type of academic disciplines that do contribute to this. But we also have human rights experts. We have lawyers. We have what science studies folks call lay experts, right? People that have sort of just educated themselves very well in the ins and outs of gender and sexuality sort of studies or theory. And they sort of use this to translate academic arguments about gender and sexuality into these legal arenas in ways that make sense to legal actors. But the state or these legal complexes really, there has to be this opening, right? There has to be some sort of opening for this expertise to sort of come into the picture. And in asylum, that ended up being, this one particular case for Fidel Toboso Alfonso, who was a gay Cuban man who came over on the Mariel Boatlift, and he lodged the first gay asylum claim, or the first documented one anyway. And that became the first sort of opening for this group of experts to really say, like, hey, you're not doing this very well. let us come help you. And they started advocating. They really started what I call insurgent expertise. They really started pushing at the doors of immigration offices and asylum offices and human rights organizations, and saying, hey, we need to start paying attention to this. Right now they're just sort of saying, like, oh, are you like a femme dude? Like, okay, then you can be gay. And they really sort of pushed their way into these settings and really sort of brought in a new lens to look at this. Okay. In the sex offender side of things, it was much more of the state actually saying, like, hey, won't you guys come in and do this for us? And they're like, yeah, sure. I mean, it was sort of a bid for professional jurisdiction for the forensic psychologists. So this idea of co-production is that new forms of regulation require new forms of knowledge, right? So, and new forms of knowledge often engender new forms of regulation. And so it's sort of this, you know, circular process of you know, creating new ways of knowing things and also new ways of regulating things at the same time.
Do you know what I was thinking as you're saying this? That actually what you're getting is a new class of moral, like a replacement of the moral entrepreneur. So I was thinking about the debates around sex work in the 1860s that came about as a consequence of like some really unpleasant legislation that the early feminists then challenged. But then instead of like sort of carrying that through, they then sort of like sided back with the state and turned on prostitution itself as a means of like survival. And it's quite interesting because I see almost elements in this conversation as well. So you have like, you know, sort of like the experts will sort of pull people out of that potential criminogy, like environment. But on the other hand, it will also push other people further into the criminal justice system. You know, it's a kind of like a push me, pull me thing. It's like, it's so interesting. I love this book. Right. So I really enjoyed it. It's excellent. People really should be reading it. You use a phrase, constitution sexuality as a risk object in need of state oversight allows the state to expand its reach both through overtly punitive and apparently benevolent means. Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say that?
What do I mean when I say that? So what I'm really trying to say there is that, and I think I go on to say something like, it positions sexuality not only to expand control over larger domains of social life, but also deeper into individual bodies, right? So by turning sexuality into a risk object, right, that is a source of risk, the state is able to position sexuality as a different thing in different realms of life. So let me provide a good example here. So like, we tend to think, we would probably look at these cases and think, okay, well, they're going to be regulated differently because when we talk about being gay or being a lesbian or bisexual, whatever, we're talking about a sexual identity, right? When we're looking at asylum law, right? We're looking at how someone proves an identity. Versus in sex offender law, we often think, okay, they're proving a behavior, right? Well, it's not that simple. It's very slippery in reality, and oftentimes identities bleed into behavior. You know, behaviors become identities. Identities are taken to imply certain behaviors. Identities are imputed to people that don't really fit, right? And so there's a lot of slippage here. And so by saying, okay, well, sexuality is a source of risk, right? But is it a risk to the community or is it a risk to the individual? And that's really the hinge for the different sort of approaches we see here. So in the case of asylum seekers, right, they're facing, their sexuality is putting them at risk from their home community, right? Versus sex offenders are, you know, perceived as putting their community at risk. And really that establishes sexuality is almost being able to be anything, right? If you can be at risk because of it or at risk from it, right? Oh, sorry, I didn't say that right, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. If you're at risk or risky,
yeah,
you can be legislated.
Yeah, sexuality becomes almost omnipresent. I mean, I would argue it basically is omnipresent, right? So sexuality becomes what Anne-Marie Mole, a science studies scholar, calls a multiplicity, right? It sort of becomes different things in different settings. And so, so in sex offender law, it's this bodily phenomena that's measured via things like the polygraph or the penile plethysmograph, which for those of you who don't know, is essentially a blood pressure cuff that's put around a man's penis. And then he's either shown porn or listens to pornographic audio vignettes or something like that. And they gauge his penile response. and so I know it's almost, it's laughable if the consequences attached to it weren't so dire, right? And so in sex offender law, sexuality really becomes this bodily phenomenon that we can gauge via the bodily or via the body and these objective, you know, quote unquote, objective indicators like a polygraph or an actuarial risk assessment. In asylum law, sexuality takes on a whole different reality, right? It's not, you can't use a polygraph or a penile plethysmograph on an asylum seeker. That would be a humanitarian violation. That was happening in the Czech Republic back in, I want to say 2012, 2011, something like that. And the EU just went at them, right? They're like, oh no, we don't do that here, you know, like, but it's this narrated, form of expressing your sexuality. Right. And so it becomes, about indicators that have to be placed in a particular context to make sense. And so what does it mean to be gay in Iran versus Canada or the United States? Right. I mean, it's different. Right. So sexuality actually takes on a different reality in each of these settings, even though we're regulating, you know, quote unquote, sexuality. And this is where I was saying, you know, well, you know, some people would come back and say, yeah, well, it is different, though. We're regulating identity in asylum versus behavior and sex crime law. But it really doesn't become that when we look at it in practice. Right. So that's really where I go with this idea of constituting sexuality as a risk object, right? It becomes something that there's this imperative to regulate because of the risk attached to it.
This is the stuff of Lombroso, isn't it? This is the stuff of
Lombroso. Oh yeah.
It's like you've got, you know, your body is inherently criminal because of your reactions. So now we need to regulate you.
Oh, that yes, there's really, definitely that biocriminality aspect.
Yeah,
there,
that is really scary. And also, as well, obviously, anyone who's listened to me for more than a second knows that I study sex work. Don't tell the rad femmes about this, you know, because I'm just imagining where they're going to go with this, you know. I'm imagining like sex working women being like incarcerated under these laws because of the risk they present to non-sex working women. This is scary stuff.
And the way that they get, you know, these standards developed around men and male bodies get applied to other bodies and other genders is also scary, right? Because You know, there aren't very many women civilly committed in the United States. And, you know, we don't know a lot about sex offenses, right? They're chronically underreported. But from what we know that over 90% of sex offenses are committed by men, and mostly against women, and girls. Oh my God, I totally lost my train of thought right in the middle of talking.
I was just thinking because in the UK, so like somebody who's been convicted of like prostitution will be classed as will be defined as a common prostitute. That's your definition. That's your identity.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. How scary that would be.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're already marked, you know.
Exactly.
So you've already been given that. There's no need to prove it because the law's been used to prove that. So let's sort of like move on a little bit because we're talking a lot.
I'm long-winded. I'm sorry.
Good. This is awesome. So how does the book explore epistemic logics? Epistemic logics. I love anything.
Oh, thank you. So the idea of epistemic logics is really that different sort of interstitial organizational spaces have different ways of knowing things. And so I borrow both from the idea, as you can tell from the term, from the idea of institutional logics, and on the other hand, from epistemic cultures, from science studies. And I sort of take parts of both of those and then tweak it a little bit to get this idea of epistemic logics. And Again, so what I really mean by this is that the way these interstitial spaces, these sort of legal scientific, these techno-scientific or techno-legal, sorry, domains come to know something are very specific to those spaces. And they're dependent on political, cultural, and institutional imperatives and factors, right? So it's dependent on the sort of cultural frames around the people that are under scrutiny, right? So whether that's a gay person or a queer person or a sex offender, they're limited by political constraints. So can we really be sympathetic to sex offenders in our current cultural context? Not so much. But on the other hand, queer people have political clout. LGBT people have political clout, and these things took shape in particular political contexts. And then finally, we have institutional constraints, right? So, what do we actually need to do in these spaces? In asylum, we need to determine who is eligible for this type of relief. Versus in sex offender law, we need to figure out who is a danger, right? So they give rise to different ways of knowing things. So if you think of, one way that sexuality is understood in our culture is as sort of residing in the body, right? The sort of born this way argument. So sort of ironically, in a sense, that argument that's been good in some ways for gaining rights for LGBTQ people can be seen in the sex offender realm as sort of not helping so much, because when we say you're born this way, it's in your DNA, it's in your brain. That implies an unchanging essence, right? That's always there, and we just have to discover it through probing the body or looking at your DNA or something like that. Well, if that cultural frame of the sort of born this way that cultural frame around sexuality is imported into this legal, this techno-legal context of sex offender law, well, then we get an approach to knowing that is centered around that idea, right? And it becomes, okay, so if we're born this way, if it's an essence in our, being, then we should look to the body for signs of sexuality, right? It's very much the sort of You know, it's not out of line with sort of scientific racism of the 19th century, when we said, oh, well, we can look at racialized people's bodies and find some sort of distinction, right? So we can look at a gay person and find a distinction, right? The longer finger on, you know, whatever the index finger test is, right? Like, oh, if your index finger is longer than your pointer finger, no, there's the same thing. I can't remember what it was, but you know, there's all these things about like, oh, it'll be marked on the body or, but the attempt here, right, is to find some like biological or physiological marker of sexuality. And so I explore basically how these different epistemic logics get built into and institutionalized within these spaces. And I show how this is both legally adjudicated, you know, how they have these legal skirmishes over what certain terms like other specified paraphilia means. And I also show how it sort of develops on the expert side of things, right? How these expert clashes happen. And so at the risk of being long-winded again, I'll leave it there. I know,
it's really interesting because, again, like we were saying earlier on, this is the stuff of Lombroso and Bhattacharya. I mean, this is like, you know, you're born that way, we'll just lock you up because there's no rehabilitation. But also as well, it's kind of like you use this phrase in the book. It's like the book puts cultural common sense about sexuality under the microscope and makes the familiar strange. And it really is doing that, isn't it? It's really kind of addressing that sort of stuff that we're taking for granted, but the implications that has as well of, like, you know, rendering someone beyond redemption or beyond rehabilitation, because this is what this is, isn't it? This is an upgrading of the carceral system. You know, you're unable to change. We've put you in prison. You've come out of prison. We deem that even though you've been punished, you are unable to change. We're going to incarcerate you more. That's scary stuff. Really scary stuff. What did you learn from writing the book?
Oh my gosh, what did I learned so much. I mean, you know, I think as anyone who's written a book or done a project of any significant length knows, the way you start the project is almost never the way you end the project. And so, you know, I went in here looking at really just like, how are they proving sexuality in these domains? And that does form a good portion of the book, right? You know, there are two chapters really dedicated to like, what is empirical evidence of sexuality? But I saw so much more going on. I saw all these politics around expertise, which I wasn't necessarily like coming in to study. I saw the power that these non-state actors had in really helping to define sexuality in these very different ways, in these very distinct ways, in these different legal domains. You know, I learned about these, you know, landmark Supreme Court decisions that I think have been mined a lot. But as I took a closer look, I saw like all these sort of, you know, if you look at the footnotes, you see like these arguments that are happening around the epistemic logic, I would say, of that institution, right? Like, there's this skirmish that happens between the American Psychiatric Association and the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, which is the big professional organization for the people who do treatment and evaluation of sex offenders. And you see them like sparring in these court decisions. And ultimately, the courts side with ATSA, the sex offender treatment folks. And you see the power, right, that these different forms of expertise have, these different forms, these different ways of knowing have, to really form our our legal landscape, right? Like this is forming the way that we regulate people. But at the same time, it's in very circumscribed ways, right? So, you know, the state sets the standards for how these things can be, you know, entered into any sort of, you know, legal arena. Sorry, my keyboard. and so, you know, where I ultimately land with the book, you know, I close in my conclusion by talking about sexuality as a technology. And that definitely wasn't something I was thinking about at all when I started this book. But, you know, I started making these connections that just, you know, became so apparent as I was, you know, looking at these things from all sorts of different angles. And really, ultimately, I came to the conclusion that we really have to start reconceptualizing sexuality, not as just an identity or an ontological state, but starting to look at what can be done with and through sexuality, and how sexuality becomes a tool of social organization and social control and regulation. And so this goes back to that idea again, that sexuality is, and I struggled with this a lot, is that sexuality is like a whole different thing in asylum law than it is in sex offender law, than it is in a psychology lab, than it is in, you know, on the ground at Pride next week, you know, like, and so really we need to look at all these like multivalent ways that sexuality can be used to structure social life. And ultimately, you know, I think it needs to be much more central to sociological analysis than it currently is.
Totally. And it's like, yeah. It made me really aware, like, of just how powerful a tool it is.
Yeah.
You know, how powerful a tool, and how powerful a tool it is of, like, you know, sort of winning over kind of influential sectors of society, but at the same time victimizing less influential sectors of society. I really got from it. So who did you write the book for? Who was your target audience?
Well, you know, I definitely wanted it to be, you know, I would like sociologists to read it for my own little like academic reasons, which is that, like I said, I think sexuality needs to be more central to sociological analysis than it is. But this is really a book that I think queer studies scholars are, you know, are going to be the people who like the book the most. And that's, and, you know, those are my people. And, you know, I wrote it certainly from, you know, that sort of theoretical approach, that frame is definitely threaded through the book. And so, you know, that's always been my sort of home base. And while I really want to reach legal studies scholars and science studies scholars and, you know, sort of quote unquote mainstream sociologists, you know, this is really, my love letter to queer studies, because that's my home. Yeah.
It's so interesting though, isn't it? It's like, because there's so many other links that you can see that have gone on sort of previously. And I'm thinking about the way that women who have transgressed sexual sort of like norms. And I'm thinking about Ireland. I'm thinking about, you know, the women in this sort of like Magdalena homes and stuff like that. So they're judged. Oh, yeah. You know, informally judged and then incarcerated. And it's a kind of more kind of regulated, more official version of that kind of unofficial stigmatization. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so it's kind of like, you know, whereas before, you know, like you can go to prison and you come out of prison and technically you're free because you're walking about, but actually you're incarcerated in some sense because you can't get a job and you're judged. But this is a similar thing, isn't it? But instead of like stigma, what you're getting is a civil sentence. So it's almost like this civil sentencing is replacing the role of stigma. So what are you working on next? What's in the pipeline?
So I have a couple of projects that have grown out of this. One looking at LGBTQ encounters with and attitudes towards law enforcement. So, you know, something that as we are in Pride season is very much in the headlines right now in the States anyway. Not sure what it's like over there. I think you guys have had some of it too, right? With the skirmishes over, you know, police out of Pride and things like that. So I have that. That is developing. And I'm also starting to look at queer people's pathways to prison. So one thing that I learned doing this research is that queer people are 2 to 3 times more likely to be incarcerated than non-queer people, non-LGBTQ people. But we don't really know much about why. You know, what's going on? Why, you know, what's going on in these encounters with the police between queer people and the police, and what's going on in the criminal justice system or the criminal legal system that's causing this overrepresentation? So those are sort of a pair of linked projects that I'm sort of very in the very early stages of, about to start like my first interview for the Queer Pathways to Incarceration. So we will see how those shape up, but I'm really excited. Yeah, they've sort of, you know, grown out of my interest about, you know, the legal regulation of sexuality and queer people's encounters with the law. So yeah, I'm excited to get those started.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. A couple of like weeks ago, I interviewed someone whose book's called Aggressors in Blue, and it's quite interesting to see the police crimes against LGBTQ people.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so this is the part of the podcast where you are allowed to shamelessly self-promote. Okay, shameless advertising. So, who are you? What's the name of the book, and who publishes it?
I'm Stefan Vogler, and the name of the book is Sorting Sexualities, Expertise in the Politics of Legal Classification, published by University of Chicago Press, and it is available now on Amazon or uchicagopress.com or .edu. Sorry.
My name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent. This is the New Book Network, and this is the Sex, Sex Work, and Sexualities channel.